Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, NVIDIA's Titan is coming. Frame rating, Haswell graphics performance, Intel's going to stop making motherboards, upgrading 8-out of laptop SSDs, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 202, recorded January 24th, 2013, 50% faster. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm your host, Patrick Norton, and this is the show on the Twit Network. We try to bring you all the best, most exciting, and most useful news about computer hardware, and of course, tablets, and occasionally we might even talk about a cell phone or two. Excuse me, a smartphone. Right now, operating from behind his tablet, BCPur.com headquarters, Mr. Ryan Shrout. How are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty well. It got really cold here this week. But other than that, I'm doing all right. Yes, I have my laptop here, and I have one of those 20-inch Sony desktop all-in-one that also has a battery. So we're trying to think of a name.
Tabletop PC.
I think that fits.
I don't want to rub it in, but you might just be able to make out the big 57 for the current air temperature where I am. So
when I landed from New Orleans on Tuesday, it was 9. Not a clock, but degrees.
You know?
Before
you can
winter.
Always leave your dear old home in Kentucky.
I could. That's true.
But then you'd have to pay for property somewhere else. So that's just crazy talk. Not crazy talk, however. We should probably take a moment. And I would also actually like to take a moment to hold off. Did I tell you about this? The Astell and Current Audio Player?
No, I did not.
I talked about this on Monday on Techzilla. It's a audiophile player. There's like some 192K 24-bit songs on this. We're going to talk about high bitrate audio, and this is actually the nicest portable audio player I've seen in forever. As well it should be, given what they charge for this delightful little device.
It's got a volume knob on the side.
I like that. I was probably the last person I knew to carry around a dedicated media player device. You know, that was also old enough to have like a cell phone and that kind of deal, right? So not, you know, some of the cousins and stuff that had iPods and stuff like that. I had a Zune HD until not very long ago, 4 months.
Nice
it was
interface.
Great. And the simplicity of kind of having the music and the podcast kind of all in the same place was really nice. And you don't, on the Android OS, you don't quite get that, but yeah.
No. Well, we should probably talk a little bit more about computer hardware as much as we'd like to talk about audio file grade playback, Android, iOS, and more. But we started talking about this before CES, frame rating, which is you are working at PC Pro on a new metric for evaluating GPUs. And we talked a little bit. Well, actually, I should point this out. You talked a lot. I just listened and nodded my head and occasionally asked a question. But what's going on? Where are you guys at in terms of the process? And should we start with you know, I think finding and defining stutter is the main thrust of part two of your write-up up on PCPro.com?
So yeah, the defining of stutter is there's two big problems we have to go with here. Is defining what a stutter is. There's various kinds of it. We can talk about how we're trying to define it, and then also like how you detect it. Stutter comes in two kinds of, I would say, major categories, what I would call major stutters and micro stutters, or major and minor stutters. And major stutters are where you see these visible hiccups in video or in gaming, rather, not video at all. When you see where you're moving the mouse and you can feel the difference between the arc that your character should be taking while you're moving the mouse or hitting the keyboard or whatever it is. And the actual arc that it takes on the screen, and you'll see it kind of catch up. Maybe you'll mm-hmm. see a motion, and it'll stutter and kind of catch up. When we look at micro stutter, that is more along the lines of these very quick deviations in frame render times from 30 milliseconds to 16 milliseconds to 30 and 16 and back. Anything that deviates from a standard consistent frame time, and I'm saying frame time, and there might be new information for a lot of people who are just used to hearing the word frame rate, and they're right. They're very similar things. They're related. A frame time is the amount of time that one frame takes to render. If you average that out, you get a frame rate. So you can have think of a frame time as an instantaneous frame rate. If a frame takes 16 milliseconds to render, its instantaneous frame rate is 60 frames per second. But if it takes, you know, twice that, you're looking at 30 frames per second and so on. So frame times is just a kind of a more detailed way, a more discrete way to look at these individual things. You know, and we talked about it a little while ago with the first frame rating video that we did, where we talked about the hardware we were using. We talked about the capture capability that we had. This one, we actually showed you a few animations, and I know we were showing a couple of them on the screen there. And we show you a couple of animations, one in Dirt 3, one in Dishonored, where we say, here is real-time playback of what a stutter is. Here it is being played back at quarter speed, so you can kind of focus in on it. And then we use VDub, which is just, you know, we use it for video playback essentially because it allows us to step through the recordings frame by frame. And we show you exactly where it happens. And then we can actually show you where, you know, on a regular pattern, you should see maybe 2, 3, or 4 portions of a frame on the screen at any given time, right? Where you'd normally see like tearing and that kind of stuff, where when a stutter occurs, you'll usually see 2 frames or more of the same frame and then followed up very quickly by like 5 or 6 frames merge onto one screen. And that is kind of like this compression that occurs. There's some anomaly that causes a stutter. It could be the GPU. It could be the driver. It could be your hard drive. It could be your processor. There's all kinds of things that it could be causing the stutter. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to figure out how to define it and how to detect it. I mean, we're doing things like probably what we'll do long term is when we automate the capability to measure these frame times through a capture utility, mm-hmm. we can, you know, like average out the last 10 frames, see how much the current frame differs from those previous ones, and measure stutter to a numerical value that we haven't been able to do before.
So will at some point we'll also be able to detect if it's a game issue, a driver issue, a graphics card issue, or at this point is I guess obviously the first big step is measuring stutter. Is the second or third step, okay, one, detecting it, two, measuring it, third, can you start to isolate what's actually causing stutter? I mean, you know, I'm having this mental image of like calling up NVIDIA or AMD and being like, hey, it's a driver issue, or hey, you know, why are frames cleared like that in the memory buffer?
So I think it will be fairly difficult to pinpoint exactly what's causing it. But what we can do is compare side by side. What does AMD's hardware and software do? What does NVIDIA's hardware and software do? What does NVIDIA's Crossfire do? What does NVIDIA's Crossfire do? And we can maybe eliminate some variables and then maybe go down and say it's actually at the engine level. It's actually something else other than that. To get a super, super clear picture, we'd actually have to have hooks in the game engine itself that would be able to tell us when the game engine's actually requesting a frame, how long it thinks the frame took, because there's eventually when we get to the point where we're ready to show a bunch of results from this, we're going to dive into all the different stages that happen between the time a game engine sets a state in a game world and an image is displayed on your screen. And the number of steps that happen, both inside the game engine, inside DirectX, inside the driver, is pretty substantial. And the problem we see is that FRAPS, the application that most people use to measure graphics performance today, mm-hmm. sits very, very closely to where the game engine is. It knows when the game engine thinks a frame has finished, whether or not it has or not. You know, there's a different debate there. And that's what it reports. But as it progresses through the system and through the driver, a lot of stuff can happen that maybe tries to balance it or maybe drops frames when they're not necessary and things like that, that I think our new testing method will be able to dive into and get information from that we haven't been able to see before.
That would be nice.
Yeah, it's a long-term thing. It's both because of some restrictions we're under and because I think it makes sense. We're kind of bringing this information out piece by piece, hoping to, rather than output a single 30,000 word document with an hour long video about how all this works, try to get, here's a little piece, here's a little piece, right. here's some more, have discussions and, you know, get feedback from the community and the other people in this industry as we do these. And so far it's been pretty good. Even, you know, we've had calls with AMD and we've had calls with NVIDIA about what are you doing that's different than what other people are doing? And you know, they want to know all this kind of stuff. They want to get involved in the discussion, which is good.
It's always nice to boil the lobster by putting it in the cold water first, rather than taking a lobster, dropping it in a boiling pot and having the lobster explode all over you, the pot, and the rest of the room. So it's good to take things slow. Something that broke last week, we didn't really get a chance to talk about because we were enjoying our sort of post-CES wrap-up. So AMD, NVIDIA, constantly battling for market superiority in a future. But AMD last week accused, or the week before, accused NVIDIA employees of, quote, downloading and stealing 100,000 documents on the way out of AMD's door. Ryan did the write-up, of course, for PCPer.com. And it's basically three employees that were leaving AMD for NVIDIA. AMD claims that they downloaded over 100,000 files onto external hard drives in the 6 months before leaving the company. All three and another manager, Richard Hagen, were accused of recruiting AMD employees after leaving for NVIDIA. You know, VP of Strategic Development, Robert Feldstein. I mean, this is pretty serious. This is pretty serious stuff. I mean, is this corporate espionage? Is this, you know, were the 100,000 files emails? Did they include lunch discussions? I mean, how serious is this? And does stuff like this happen very often?
It probably happens more often than we know.
Right.
And the fact that AMD is kind of making a public deal about it tells me that maybe these documents are fairly important. So Feldstein, the guy who is the highest ranking person from AMD that left to go to NVIDIA, was the guy who brokered the deals for the consoles. So he is what put AMD in the Wii U and in the Xbox that's coming out and the PlayStation that's coming out, right? So he made some very impactful decisions and did some impactful things while he was at AMD. And it was a big deal in July when he announced he was leaving and going to NVIDIA.
Right.
I think at that point, maybe some people... go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, because the mere act of losing him, I think, is probably more frightening than losing 100,000 documents. I mean, obviously, it depends what's in the documents. But the guy who's brokering the deals that promise to bring you a revenue stream for the next 5 or 8 years, that's got to be a painful one to take.
Yeah, it definitely is. When he left in July, some people thought that he's maybe going to help get NVIDIA in these consoles. So those deals had already been done. Right. So NVIDIA was hoping to get his expertise going forward. And the potential problem with this is he recruited other employees, which is obviously a big no-no, according to some agreements they had with him. And then the idea is that he might have recruited these specific employees because of their access to these documents, which would also be bad. Right. And it becomes a deal between these ex-AMD employees and AMD. Mm-hmm. Unless something should come out like NVIDIA specifically requested these employees because they had access to these specific documents, right? And then it will get into the corporate espionage thing as opposed to rogue employees just doing really stupid things that they shouldn't have done before they left. But I wish I knew what was in the files, but I have no idea.
Yeah, and I wonder if the court penalties are perhaps harsher if it's NVIDIA's request or if it's the employee. You know, it probably would be bad to be one of these employees, period, right now.
Yep.
I mean, you got to wonder, is NVIDIA, I would be curious if this happens more than we think it does. I'd also be really curious to know if it's in those documents.
Yes,
while we're talking about graphics, we should probably talk about are these so Intel Haswell HD graphics compared to GeForce GT650s. How are Haswell's, you know, can we play video games with Haswell, or are we still going to want a discrete chipset for our gaming and or just being able to run Windows 8 or Windows 7?
Can you? Absolutely you can. So they're claiming that the graphical performance of Haswell will equal the GeForce GT650M, which is pretty good. They showed it playing Dirt 3. Yeah, you can see it there in the screenshots. Showed it playing Dirt 3, playing at 1080p. They tried to do like a side-by-side. Which one? I bet you can't tell which one is Intel and which one's the NVIDIA discrete. And I said, well, the one on the left is it's like stuttering a little bit during the intro.
Right.
And then later they said the one on the left was the Intel one. So I kind of felt bad for ruining their demo for them right there on the spot. But it was pretty good. It was better than expected. We're expecting to see a roughly 2x increase in graphics performance over Ivy Bridge. So I think most people will be able to take that and run with that information.
Haswell, do we have a solid, I mean, is June 2nd, 2013, is that still the solid date for Haswell release?
I don't know how solid it is, but that's still the date. Yeah.
Are we gonna
Computex
see,
would be a perfect time for that launch.
Are we going to see mobile parts first or desktop parts first?
I don't know. I don't know for sure yet. I think with Ivy Bridge, we saw quad-core mobile and desktop launch at about the same time. So it wouldn't surprise me to kind of see the same the same result there.
And suddenly I wanted to wait a few more months before buying my next CPU.
Always you do, yeah.
This is just, Oh, man. So, Ryan, what's the story on the Corsair Carbide, the 200R? It's a $49 case from a reputable manufacturer. Would you build a PC with this case?
Yeah, you know, I think I would. We did a little quick video unboxing of it that showed for $49, and I think you can get it for like $39 after a little rebate. Mm-hmm. It has a lot of great features in it. It's made out of steel. It's not super rigid. It's smaller as you would expect. It's got a ton of space in there. And what I like especially is it still has things like the grommeted holes in the back for cable routing. It has room for pretty much every place where there you can have a fan. You can put either a 120 or a 140. And there's room for a lot of those there. Front panel USB 3, you can see there. If you open it up on the back there, I think it's going to show like the cable openings and that kind of stuff. Huge CPU backplate opening. It also has 3.5-inch hard drive bays that are toolless and then 2.5-inch hard drive bays that are toolless. So your SSDs, which even on current trays have usually had to have, you know, screws in them, and they're actually more of a pain in the butt because they're so tiny. These are kind of screwless as well, but the cables stick out towards the motherboard as opposed to going into the back of the system to be cleanly routed and that kind of stuff. But overall, I mean, yeah, I came away from the case really enjoying it and thinking, you know, the problem for Corsair and anybody in this price range is there's probably 200 cases on Newegg that are in the $30 to $80 price range, right? And it's hard to stand out doing a search on Amazon or Newegg or something like that. So the capability to, I think, lean on their company name, to lean on, you know, what they've built with the other Corsair parts will probably help them out quite a bit.
Yay. I don't know. It's always nice when there's an inexpensive case that has some intelligent design inside of it. I'm curious. Scott wrote this up at PCPro.com. SimCity Beta opens this weekend. Best hour of your life. So I'm a little confused. EA is going to allow beta access, or EA is going to allow beta access for 1 hour this weekend?
Those are both correct statements.
And this is the special version of SimCity that's got like the Instagram filters, right?
No, this is the new SimCity. SimCity 5. Right. And they have a beta weekend going, but it's kind of odd because they're only going to let people play for 1 hour, which it just seems weird for me. Like, I don't understand why they would do it for just a single hour. Are they trying to test server load? Are they trying to see, like, how does the first hour of the game play? How well does it teach people?
Right.
It's really weird. This weekend, we're going to live stream our beta playthrough at pcper.com/live. I don't know what time yet, either Friday or Sunday, depending on how preloading goes and all that kind of stuff. But I think a lot of people are looking forward to this. This is one of the first games that really got me into the whole idea of simulation. I guess it's not a turn-based game. It's not even really, you're not even right. really playing against anybody, right? So it's the god syndrome game, right? You know, and building up your city and destroying it.
A friend of mine nearly took both himself and myself out of college in one semester by putting SimCity on his machine. And basically, if he wasn't playing it, I was playing it. We just hours and hundreds of hours. It could have been used for almost anything else, like studying and getting better grades. But I mean, March 5 is the official release date for the new version of SimCity. Pre-orders are available. And it's kind of funny, if you go to simcity.com, what's in the beta? Here's the answer straight from lead producer Kip Katsarelis. The closed beta is an important step for us, blah, 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 blah. We've crafted a one-hour replayable experience that will let you enjoy the magic of the game and allow us to test critical features. Everyone will go through our getting started scenario, which takes you through the basics of how to play the game and gives you a sneak peek of some late game content. After that, you're free to start your own city and play for 1 hour. I mean, it's just, you know, all the tools to build up a medium density city, access to the casino big business, basic services, public transportation options, several options on how you can bring power to your city. You can start up as many cities as you like during the 3-day event. We encourage you to try to build different types of cities, explore the leaderboards, and try to beat the global challenge. Basically, so it's a mad, crazy beta test. And then, you know, that what the information they learn goes back to the development team. How exciting. How frustrating it's going to be. And by the way, it's Windows only. So if you're on a Mac, deal with it. You're waiting until March. So, oh my goodness. Are you excited? I mean, are you super excited?
I want to be. We'll see. We will see. After that hour, I'll let you know.
It's no Oculus Rift. Rumors of a new awesomest graphics card ever. It's actually been several weeks since we've had the world's fastest graphic card announcement here on This Week in Computer Hardware. NVIDIA GK110 based GeForce GPU Titan to be released late February is the rumor. Ryan, I quote, a combination of rumors and news pieces found online and in some recent conversations with partners indicates that February will see the release of a new super high-end graphics card from NVIDIA based on the GK110 GPU. Sweetclocker says the name's going to be Titan, single GPU card, 2,688 CUDA cores, up from 1,536 in the GeForce GTX 680, or approximately like 70 shields.
Pretty close, yeah.
Is this going to be a workstation project, or is this going to be a absolutely smoking fast desktop gaming card?
So the workstation kind of professional level product already exists as a Tesla card. This will be a GeForce graphics gaming card. $899 price range. We're talking a 75% increase in compute units over the current single GPU GTX 680, and 384-bit memory bus on the GPU as opposed to 256. The clocks are down a little bit. But we're talking, so the GTX 690 is based on two GK104s, right? It's a dual GPU card. The rumor from Sweet Clockers is that this Titan card will have approximately 85% of the performance of the GTX 690, but it'll be a single GPU and be about $150 less in price than the GTX 690 as well. So it's still expensive, $900 for a graphics card, if this all turns out to if this all happens to pan out. But super impressive performance. Like,
yeah,
I mean, if it's hitting 85, I mean, that's enormous, right? Greater than a teraflop of double precision performance.
I was just looking, like 7.1 billion transistors over a teraflop. You know, 1.5 megabytes of L2 cache, which is larger than the GPU and, or excuse me, the CPU and the computer I'm using right now. You know, is there going to be, I mean, you know, if you're going to estimate, Ryan, what would you say a bump in performance would be compared to some of the top of line? Well, I guess compared to the GTX 680. I mean, do you expect a significant bump from the increase in CUDA cores, or is it just more of a...
So you're getting a 75% increase in shader count, core count, but you're probably dropping in clock speed by 20 to 25%. So I'd expect to see about a 50% performance increase over a GTX 680 today.
Wow.
I think, if it all pans out, right? And the benefit of it being a single GPU is you don't have to worry about some of the minor issues that you get with multi-GPU setups, right? Micro stutter and the potential for balancing issues and that kind of stuff. All that power is in a single chip. And it may use a lot of power too.
That's going to be, yeah, I'm going to say you can probably be able to boil water with that one. So, I mean, obviously we're all going to be excited to see that one get benchmarked. Even if it was a mere 30% improvement over the GTX 680, that would still be obscene. 50% would be amazing. Strange but true, strange but false. Intel will be walking away from the motherboard business.
It's very true. They've announced it officially that over the next 3 years, they're going to, they say, diversify their team. They're going to basically shut down their retail motherboard business.
I mean, is this signifying, because I think you and I discussed at some point, I feel like we discussed at some point probably post CES, since I don't think we actually saw each other at CES, but for like 30 seconds. But Intel's obviously, you know, they want to be ARM, they want to be mobile, and it's almost like they're ready to walk away from the desktop platform. Is that overstating it? Or, I mean, and we should also point out 3 years is an awfully long time. This just seems like a very early announcement. Like, are they doing this to kind of ease the reaction from Wall Street or the consumers, or, you know, why would they say in 3 years we're not going to do motherboards anymore?
I think that's correct, that they're just trying to prepare everybody for this before they suddenly start pulling out. I mean, they're going to make Haswell motherboards, right? They've announced that they're going to make and support Haswell motherboards. They're going to support the warranty on all the current boards, and then what you're going to see instead is that team's going to focus on different product segments like the Intel Nook. Maybe super thin mini ITX platforms and that kind of stuff. You know, they're seeing the desktop market change. I think it's going to be easy for conspiracy theorists to see this as another case of Intel doesn't care about desktop. They don't care about the enthusiast. They're moving away from all that kind of stuff. And there's some validity to that. But you got to look at it. There's a ton of companies out there, Asus and MSI and Gigabyte and those guys. They make high quality products. I've been impressed with the Intel motherboards as of late, but they're not necessary in the market. But you always kind of have to worry and wonder when a major player like this kind of steps back.
Right. I mean, they'll still be creating chipsets. They'll still be creating CPUs. There's still going to be a desktop market for the foreseeable future. I could see a point where they figure out how to make the delta in performance between the desktop and the mobile parts continue to get smaller and smaller. But they've always been like, you know, big stacks of blue boxes available at your computer store or, you know, at Newegg or Amazon. Asus, on the other hand, wants to make sure that everybody knows that they love desktop motherboards. I mean, is that a quote? We are still sorry to see Intel leave the business, at least after Haswell, but it is good to have companies like this coming out and assuring us of their support. That was actually you. I'm quoting there, that Asus didn't actually say they were sad to see Intel leave the business.
No, Asus isn't going to be happy about it. Well, Asus and the other guys are going to be a little bit happy about Intel leaving. It's just a little bit more market share for them. But they basically were just kind of coming out and saying, hey, we're committed to this market. We are the enthusiasts and the DIY friends. So remember us when you realize that Intel is abandoning your market, I guess.
Yeah. You know, I will say I've one thing I can say about Intel's motherboard is that I've never had an Intel motherboard fail. I've had motherboards from almost every other manufacturer fail. So that is anecdotal, non-statistical, and not a large aggregate group. But I've had a lot of luck with Intel motherboards. Just didn't get to overclock them very much in the early days. So we should probably take a moment to thank our sponsor. Mm-hmm. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, Bespoke, is stepping up and sponsoring the show this week. Ryan, can you tell us a little bit more about what Bespoke has to offer?
So Bespoke Post is a service. Let's see. They call it a subscription service for men. Each month, Bespoke Post sends you an exclusive package with products ranging from gadgets to accessories and more. There's a whole lot of kind of interesting stuff that you'll get. And one of my favorite parts about it is it's kind of a surprise at times, right? You get a little bit of a heads up beforehand, but I like kind of having the variants that they'll offer. They have a team of experts that scour the world to discover the best and most unique products. Then each month they send a theme box of awesome, which I feel like should be a copyrighted thing there, box of awesome to members.
Good name.
Filled with these amazing products and experiences. They also give you tips and how to use them and all that kind of stuff, of course. You can view the past boxes at bespokepost.com/box/past. They've included coffee kits, cocktail sets, a shaving kit. It's $45 per box with free shipping and returns if there's any issues. The retail value of the box is always above the monthly subscription cost. And at the beginning of the month, they let the members know what their limited edition selection, and they can opt out if they don't want to be charged for that month's box. So a one-month gift is $50. 3 months is $135. Half year, $270. And for if you have any people in your life, any men in your life that are impossible to buy for, this may be the right thing for you. It's, you can find out more information at bespokepost.com/twit. And I think we got a little bit of the box for January was a polished. They called it polished. And it was all kinds of accessories and equipment for polishing your shoes, something that I think a lot of people of my generation have little to no experience doing. And it's kind of cool to have all the supplies given to you, the brush, the creams, all that stuff, the buffing, and then the bag to put your shoes in and kind of learn about that kind of stuff to take care of these things that maybe some people don't. So again, 20% off your first box, actually, which is a great deal if you go to bespokepost.com/twit. Again, that's bespokepost.com/twit. And we thank them for their support of our show and many of the shows on This Week in Tech Network.
Yeah, no, my wife has pirated the linen blanket that was in the sample Bespoke Post box we got. She's like, oh, linen. And the linen beach blanket or towel, I should say, the linen beach towel, the linen beach spread that came in the summer box is gone. More's the pity. But they have some nice gear packed into those boxes. I was pleasantly surprised by the quality. Bespokepost.com /twit. Pardon me, I've excited the train rolled by behind me and didn't collapse on the building. So we talk about news on This Week in Computer Hardware, and we love to answer your questions. If you want to send one in to us, do us a favor, email us twitch@twit.tv. And if I slide up to our first question, Kevin is looking to, well, he's actually thinking about an SSD upgrade for his Ultrabook.
He says, I made a grave mistake this past summer in my desire to have my new Ivy Bridge Core i7 Ultrabook now. I settled for a 128 gigabyte SSD instead of waiting another month for the 256 gigabyte version to be released. I bought NASA's ZenBook Prime UX31A Ultrabook. I love the laptop, but I am bumping into the 128 gigabyte limit daily. I have a mixed use case for it, but essentially I need both productivity and the occasional hour or two of loading up a game off of Steam. I'm an engineer and have some of my FPGA tools loaded, which take tons of space. I don't use it as my main engineering workstation, but I am on the go, and it handles the occasional simulation or coding session at the coffee shop or airport well enough. Anyway, if you do the research, you find that the Ultrabook contains an ADATA X11 OEM SSD. Gets awesome speeds, by the way, he says. Special form factor, connector, etc., but not soldered in, so there is hope. Doesn't look like you can buy it anywhere except this somewhat questionable looking website, which I think was asusparts.eu. Think it's crazy to just go for it? Yeah, that's a website. I can use PayPal, so there is a slight bit of protection if it doesn't show up. So what would you recommend for what would you recommend for our viewer in this case?
I would not purchase anything from that website. I don't know anything about it. They may be perfectly fine people, Klarna, that kind of deal. They're not affiliated with Asus in any way. I can tell you that.
Right.
Take your chances.
However,
there is
like a reputable, well-known manufacturer.
Exactly. OWC yes. makes them, although they're branded for the Mac. They're not branded for your device. And I'm 99% sure this will work in your system. I'm not 100% sure. Right. But the Asus and MacBooks share a lot of the same infrastructure. And even though I know there are a couple of standards that look like mm-hmm. this in terms of SSD, I'm almost 100% sure that these with a 2011 MacBook Air match up. Now, they're not cheap still. 240 gigs is $320.
But you not only get the new drive, but you get an enclosure so you can actually use your original internal SSD as an external device. So it's kind of, you know, it's not cheap, but it's kind of cool the way they set it up, that you basically install the new drive and then pack the old drive into this enclosure, copy your data over to your machine. Yeah. And then you get a really cool external enclosure that was designed essentially to work with MacBook Air. so it's aesthetically pleasing. But yes. I thought that was kind of cool, the idea of having all of a sudden having a 120 gigabyte external enclosure.
Yeah. That's a plus too.
I would also like to point out that Kevin did not follow the prime rule of Twitch, which is to wait before you buy.
No, that's Patrick's rule of Twitch. Oh, Ryan's rule of Twitch is to buy.
It's because you don't have any kids yet.
That's true. This is true.
Paul's got a question about audio out of the PC throughout the house. He says, I've been using a cheap receiver and tuner for my audio throughout my house connected to the line into my computer. I have ground problems. It's never smooth audio, and I feel there must be a better way. Currently, I have 6 speakers in various places in the house, and I just want a better solution for all the audio coming from my computer. Oh, boy.
I threw this in here. I thought you might have some kind of magic solution. The first thing that came to mind, anytime I hear distributed audio, I think of Sonos. But it's extremely expensive, and it's not really meant for outputting whatever audio you happen to have out of your computer across your house. Right. It's more meant for specific music services throughout your house, like Pandora and Spotify and your iTunes library.
It's funny because we actually, you know, we started with one Sonos box in my house, and now I think we have 1, 2, 3, maybe 4.
Same here.
That, you know, there's one in the family room on my wife's desk. There's one in the kitchen. There's one in our bedroom. I think I'm projecting the fourth one because I can see where it would work really, really nicely in the kids' bedroom. You know, then we can get one of the adapters for the home theater system in the living room. But basically, though, we can pretty much blanket 3/4 of the house with the 3 units. You can set them up so you can gang them all together so that everything's playing the same music. You can select individual rooms. You know, my wife can be listening to Annie DeFranco and raging in the family room, or I'm listening to, you know, punk or Bach in the back bedroom. We
can do something else in the kitchen. You know, it's funny, almost all of the, you know, if I'm not in my car, if I'm actually listening to radio, it is on the Sonos boxes. There is no functioning radio in my house except for the super emergency solar powered AM radio that's in the earthquake kit. So yeah, something like Sonos is certainly an option, and there are a number of competitors to that. You know, the thing is, you know, when I, the thing that kind of that made me groan though, you know, because there's nothing wrong with an inexpensive receiver and tuner and connecting to a whole bunch of speakers in your house. If it works, don't fix it. But ground problems, you know, make me think if there's a ground loop hum, right, which essentially is a disagreement in the way your house is wired and the way things are plugged in, you know, they're, you know, eliminating ground loops can be an incredible pain. But, you know, search on ground loop hum if it is an actual ground loop hum, and that'll, there's a number of websites that'll walk through how to fix that. But the other question is, if it's not smooth audio, I'm wondering what your source is. Is it, you know, is it Rhapsody? Is it a local collection of files you've ripped yourself? Is it an especially old computer? Because audio, which used to be incredibly taxing to rip and encode and play back 10, 15 years ago when MP3 was still this like incredibly new thing and 128K was the spec. But audio shouldn't be taxing on your computer. So if you are having problems with the audio, you know, being, you know, not being smooth and not playing back, something's wrong in the application you're using to play back the audio. That would be the first thing I would say. You know, if you're worried about smoothness, you know, the source of the audio can be an issue. If you have, you know, Pandora sounds, you know, it's somewhere to me, you know, AM, FF, you know, well, it's better than AM. if Pandora sounds like AM, you probably have, you know, a DSL connection and somebody's probably watching Netflix in the background. So it should at least sound as good as the FM stereo in your car. You know, but if you have a whole bunch of stuff going on where multiple people are using the internet in your house and that's causing you to have issues with the audio, something you can do is go into your router or purchase a router that allows you to do, allows you to sort of rank the order of services so that, for example, Skype conversations are more important than, you know, background downloads, which are more important than websites, you know, in terms of loading stuff. So quality of service, QoS, can make a healthy difference in the performance of how your applications run. But you'll have to configure that inside of your router. And yeah, you know, there are like 32,000 ways to skin this cat. And I think Ryan kind of like either do discrete boxes that contain speakers or discrete boxes that connect to speakers, or you use the existing wiring in your house. And it may be worth, you know, rewiring the speakers and upgrading the speakers. Polk and several other manufacturers make very portable speakers that are, you know, you know, there's a lot of ways to go. Are the speakers in the walls? Are the speakers in the ceilings? Are the speakers just sitting around? There's a lot of ways to skin this particular cat, and you kind of need to decide, you know, do you want to just play the same thing in every room in the house? Do you want separate programs available for different rooms in the house? Do you want a discrete box you can put on a shelf and not worry about, you know, what else it's plugged into because it's wireless and it just needs a power cord? Or do you want to continue to power stuff off of this, you know, basically provide the audio from the receiver in the center portion of your house? And I've probably babbled way too long about this, so I'm going to stop.
No.
Before I put Ryan to sleep. But you know, the other thing is like, hey, you know, what's the quality of the audio that you're playing? Is it, you know, locally stored lossless files? Is it a weak audio connection to a remote source? There's just lots and lots and lots of places to start. Get a good source, get a good playback, start thinking about whether or not it's time to upgrade your hardware and upgrade your speakers and stuff. So
let's do maybe one more email this time.
Yes.
We got from Jonathan. It says, I just started listening to the podcast and I think it's great. Welcome, Jonathan. Thanks, forget Jonathan. All the back episodes. I have a question that hopefully you can answer. I'm an architect major, and so I'm always rendering 3D models on my computer. I reached a point where the current store-bought PCs just wouldn't meet my needs, so I built my own PC, and it worked great. But now that my models are getting larger, these renders take about 6 hours to complete. I use Autodesk's Revit program to render, so my question is, how do I decrease the time I spend rendering? I've looked online, and there are mixed comments that say CPU decreases rendering times, while others says while others say it's all about the graphics card. Which do you think would be a major increase in performance? And his system included the relative components were an AMD FX 4170 and a GeForce GTX 550 Ti. So I tried to do a little bit of research on this. I'm not familiar with the Revit application specifically, but everything that I read said that it was not a GPU-accelerated rendering engine. That it was instead a CPU-based rendering engine, as a lot of them are still today. What I'll do here is, let me see, I was pulling up the relative rendering performance, and I'll put it in the chat room to our 3770K review. And essentially, the AMD FX 4170 that he has is a Bulldozer-based part. It's a quad-core, not the 8-core, so it's two modules quad-core. And a 3770K is about 65% faster than the 8-core Bulldozer.
Nice.
On single-threaded. And about, I don't know, let's say 25 to 30% faster than the 8-core Bulldozer fully threaded.
Right.
So you're going to see some significant performance improvements jumping up from that, especially since you're going from a quad-core AMD up to, say, like if you got a Core i7-3770K, a quad-core hyper-threaded Intel part. Now, you can always go a little bit higher. Depends on how much money you want to spend. You could get Sandy Bridge E, where you can have 6 cores hyper-threaded, right, and get a little bit more performance out of it. And I forgot to mention his graphics card was a GeForce GTX 550 Ti, which is not, you know, it's if there was GPU rendering, GPU accelerated rendering, that's not a really great card for that. I would probably, if it supports OpenCL, I would have recommended like an AMD 7000 series. But since I read that Revit was CPU based, I'm going to have to go with, you know, I have to upgrade that processor. If you don't want to change motherboards, you can move up to an AMD FX 8350, which is the new updated Bulldozer. Is that pile driver core? And it's twice as many cores as well. So that should help. If you really, really want to change and update things, you're going to have to get a new motherboard, new processor, and kind of change your platform around that way.
One thing also to keep an eye on is what year the application it basically, like, I think Revit, where is it? Here it is. There was a 4-processor core limit in place at least through the 2010 version of Revit. 2011 products can use all of the products. And 2011 and later versions of Revit can use the total number of cores on the workstation during rendering, which is a big deal. Different. It's funny because you start looking at the Revit, but one, make sure you've got at least the 2011 or newer version of it. It's funny to watch people starting testing new systems. Like this is like RevitClinic.typepad.com has done some stuff on improving Revit rendering times. And a lot of it involves, like, you know, what DPI are you rendering at and which Revit renders are you doing? Because I guess Mental Ray does not get accelerated by a GPU. And then iRay can be accelerated by a GPU. So I think it can apparently vary a lot depending on what type of render you're doing and in what section of the application. But definitely make sure that you've got something 2011 and newer. Man, rendering can ruin you if it's not fast enough. It can be
that's
so
the place where computing horsepower is never, you're never going to say you have too much or you have enough.
And video editing. We're going to be talking about, a whole bunch of exciting stuff next week on This Week in Computer Hardware, including the legendary classic question, is there a performance difference between IDE and AHCI settings in the BIOS? I just love that question from John. We'll get to that one next week. What's coming up on PC Per this week?
So this week we're going to look at that Sony Tap 20. It's off camera here, but it's a 20-inch tablet. It's a 20-inch all-in-one touchscreen that also has a battery, so you can, it's kind of semi-portable with 2 to 3 hours of battery life, and it weighs 11 pounds. So do you, are you interested in an 11 pound tablet? We'll kind of discuss that. And then a lot more work on that frame rating stuff is going on here. We've actually switched our storage system around from a PCI. Get this. We moved from a PCI Express SSD, PCIe, you know, solid state drive to a Thunderbolt external array with SSDs inside of it, and have had more success with capturing capability on that. So we'll discuss a little bit more of that and the reasons for it as well. And then we have at least two motherboard reviews ready to go out, and it's a little bit quiet right now until like February and March are going to be slammed with stuff. Like the whole first two quarters after you get through January, we're going to see a lot of hardware releases.
Nice. I wait with bated breath because I am in desperate need of a new GPU. Oh my goodness, is my GPU old? And no, I will not name it because I will be mocked, yes, both by Ryan, possibly by Burke, and definitely by the chat room. Should be an interesting week next week. We're going to have Kyle Weens from iFixiton. He's going to be doing a teardown, possibly, of the GoPro Hero.
Nice.
One of the new GoPro cams, or perhaps a Sonos box. I don't know. It would break my heart a little bit to watch him tear into a Sonos box, not that he could put it back together. We got the Estelle and Kern review, the new audiophile player. We're going to talk about whether or not you can actually hear the differences between 24-bit and 192K audio. And I believe Veronica has been getting all kinds of messy with Twitter's new Vine video feature, which apparently has some really interesting privacy snags, but we'll save that for Monday. So that's about it for this week in computer hardware. Twit.tv/twitch is the website where you can also find all of our old episodes and the instructions and links for subscribing to the show and your favorite podcaster.
And the new HD feed, apparently.
Ooh, we're going to have to get
all of this internet in high definition. Sometimes frozen, sometimes animated. You never know.
You know, I'm gonna be the first to say that nobody's watching me because I'm pretty and I don't. But if you want all this not pretty in HD, you can now get it in HD. We has all the bits at twit.tv/twitch. Email us twitch@twit.tv. We'll do our best to answer your question. I'm gonna say that's about it for this week in computer hardware. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Schrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.